What if NAFTA never existed? What if your genes could be spliced and moved around to make you healthier? What if William Shakespeare got to jam out with a bunch of funk musicians? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And okay, that's a fairly esoteric list of hypothetical questions. But guess what? They are all in our show this week, as we explore a little bit of what is, what could be, and what might have happened. We have stories for you this week about reimagining our world. And that means everything from our immigration policies, who gets to work in the United States, to how virtual reality designers are creating a world where you could visit a museum, see and touch its exhibits without ever leaving your house. Come talk to me or the team, and you don't even have to get off your couch for this, at marketplace.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We are going to start the show, as we often do, with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. Here to join me this week are Joe Weisenthal, co-host of Bloomberg TV's What'd You Miss, and Marketplace's senior reporter Kimberly Adams in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Lizzie.
Great to be here.
It's nice to have you guys back. This has been such a news-filled week, so we're going to do our own take on it. You know, Joe, why don't you tell us what you are long and why?
So I am long Mexico. You know, in the wake of the presidential election, we saw a big crash in the Mexican peso. It's recovered quite a bit. Tensions between the U.S. and Mexico, for obvious reasons, people assume that they're going to be on the rise. But I have two reasons why I think there could be some case for optimism in Mexico. One is, it doesn't seem like the Trump administration is particularly effective at getting that much done from what we've seen so far. So you could make the argument, well, if they want to have an antagonistic relationship, they might not be able to execute it. But even more importantly, there was an interesting interview with Peter Navarro, who is Trump's controversial advisor on trade. And he talked about changing NAFTA, but in a way that would not necessarily be bad for Mexico, essentially changing the rules of country of origin so that stuff manufactured in Mexico would actually have to be manufactured in Mexico and not just parts manufactured in Taiwan or Korea or China and then shipped to Mexico at the last second for a little bit of assembly. So I think my long Mexico trade, which is, of course, a fantasy trade in my head, has multiple ways to win.
And I think there's other reasons to be long on Mexico and a Trump administration more generally. I mean, I was doing some reporting down there around the time of the inauguration, and people were getting ready, even to the point where the mayor of Nogales, Mexico, was working on a contingency plan in case they ended up with a bunch of deported people coming from the United States and landing in his town. And if we look at Trump's budget blueprint, it includes money to build the border wall, which Mexico still says it isn't paying for. And so as antagonistic as the Trump administration wants to be towards Mexico, Mexico still has a couple of cards that they can play.
Things go back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico constantly. It's not like you're talking about a finished product moving from one country to another. Cars are making four, five, six trips back and forth. So I'm curious, when Navarro thinks about this relationship with Mexico, it sounds like he wants to renegotiate NAFTA, but for what? Another version of NAFTA?
No, it's absolutely right. This idea that one country just makes something and the other country buys it really does not fit in with how modern supply chains work at all. And there's some great example exactly of you mentioned of various car parts crossing the border multiple times on their way to the finished product.
I want to flip a little bit, Kimberly, and go with your short, because it also really gets a policy, but also kind of optimism and pessimism. What are you short?
I am short the Trump bump in the stock market. The market has been on a tear since President Trump was inaugurated and elected with optimism, as you said, that his policies were going to be great for business. But this past week, we saw the largest drop in the markets in a year as a result of some, you know, cracks showing in the idea of whether or not President Trump is actually going to be able to achieve his policy goals, especially the ones that he can't do alone from the executive branch. You can look at the backlash against his budget plan. You can look at the troubles with pushing health care through Congress. All of these things are starting to make the markets and investors say, I don't know, maybe we were a little bit too optimistic.
traders are making bets all the time, every minute.
Right.
And they're betting on the future of companies one way or another. And I'm curious whether it is wise as a country to read too much into the bets that traders make. After all, they're there to make money. They're not there to set an economic mood.
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that all of media, and I would plead guilty to this, has the tendency to see the market as a national scorecard, a national barometer. I try to avoid it, but it happens. There was this story going into the election that if Trump wins, it's going to be bad for the market, uncertainty. And then the market rallied, and suddenly people came up with a news story. It's going to be back to business and optimism in taxes. And I think it really speaks to how quickly the story can change, even without many fundamentals backing up that.
But it does matter because,
absolutely,
you know, if you're an investor and you're looking at your retirement account and you're like, great, Trump's great for my retirement portfolio, and then all of a sudden it isn't, that matters. What happens in the market does matter for many people in their pocketbooks.
And well, and their ability to figure out, you know, how they're going to plan for their lives for the next few months or years.
No, I definitely agree it matters. I mean, I spend my entire day talking about it, so you're not going to get any argument from me there.
Joe, why don't you tell us what you're short?
I'm short Korea because I think that if you buy into this thesis that more supply chains are going to be moved to North America, then who is a big loser from non-North American trade? Korea is one of the most trade-sensitive countries that there is. Mm. It sort of sits at the, you know, manufactures a lot. It's a big shipbuilder. It's very sensitive to what happens in China.
And you're talking about South Korea here. They're also extremely,
yes,
extremely sensitive to what happens to with their northern neighbor.
Yeah, they too have a potentially antagonistic northern neighbor, now that you mention it. Perhaps much more dangerous potentially than the U.S.-Mexico situation. So I think there's multiple ways to lose if you're in Korea, whether it's from a slowdown in China, whether it's more agitation from North Korea, or just a general slowdown in free trade, which is Korea's the most sensitive to it.
And also, their politics are a mess right now.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
And that, too. There's massive scandals across corporate and governance.
All right. So I'm going to try to swing us around and go with your long here, Kimberly. I guess security has been a bit of a thread here, mostly economic, but somewhat geopolitical as well. Tell us your long.
I'm going to go long on Secret Service spending. I'm hesitant to go long on the Secret Service budget because I'm not really sure that's going to get any bigger, but it's clear that they are spending more. The Secret Service, apparently, according to reporting done by the Washington Post, asked for $60 million extra to cover the additional travel and protection for President Trump and his family. It's a reminder that we're effectively, as taxpayers, maintaining three different White Houses. In Florida, we've got the White House here in Washington, D.C., not to mention his family, still spending most of their time in Trump Tower in New York, as well as protection for other members of the Trump family as they travel around the world. And the Secret Service has to pay for all of those things. But it's worth noting that protecting the president is not the only thing that the Secret Service does. They also have to investigate cyber crimes and, you know, child trafficking and exploited minors and counterfeit money. And so if their budget does not expand to accommodate this, if taxpayers aren't willing to pay more money for this, we're probably going to see some cuts in other things that the Secret Service does.
One of the questions I have, because Secret Service protection for presidents and their families is sort of a political hobby horse often for the party not in power. You know, there were stories about protecting Michelle Obama when she went on a trip. I remember that, you know, those coming from the Republicans. Do we think that Americans can think about Secret Service protection in a way that is apolitical, or do these things always become knitted together with who you like and who you don't like?
I think it's always going to be political. I mean, the same with many of the budget priorities that are constantly brought up by the opposing groups in any administration. You'll find, you know, Democrats railing against Republicans on health care spending. And when fortunes change, Republicans are railing against Democrats. And so, yes, a lot of these things are tied into just who you like and who you don't. But at the same time, these are really hard numbers. And for government and an administration that's speaking quite vehemently about cutting government spending, these numbers can be a little bit hard to swallow.
Bloomberg's Joe Weisenthal, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, thank you both so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
We love our numbers here at Marketplace. It's kind of what we do. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Tony Wagner and Sarah Menendez as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Take it away, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
166.3 million.
That's many times more life. Drake's new playlist, Do Not Call It an Album, was streamed on Spotify and Apple Music in its first 24 hours.
It's a new single-day record for both platforms, and so far has earned about 3.5 million in streams alone.
Spotify reported earlier this week that Drake is its first artist to reach about 10 billion streams.
At 0.005 cents per stream, that's more than $50 million, and counting.
Most of those streams are Sarah. 69.
That's how many new emojis Unicode will introduce this summer.
The next generation includes zombies, giraffes, pretzels, and dumplings.
The dumpling emoji has been a long-term project for Jennifer Ait Lee, CEO of the literary startup Plimpton.
She raised over $12,000 in an effort to join Unicode's technical committee, which proposes and votes on new emojis. Membership in the committee costs $7,500.
Lee used the rest of the funds to lobby for her dumpling and other fan favorite emojis.
If you're looking for a way to express your feelings about all this, a shocked face with exploding head emoji is coming your way soon.
9 million.
That's the number of Starbucks customers that use their phones to pay for their coffee.
Next month, the company will allow people to send Starbucks gift cards via Apple's iMessage.
An incredible 1 in 6 American adults get Starbucks gift cards during the holiday season.
So will the convenience of iMessage gift cards be a boon for business?
We can talk about it over coffee. You know that I'm working, I'll be there
soon as I make it home. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Never pay attention to the rumors and what they assume.
And tell them girls. One thing you hear politicians talk about a lot, the manufacturing jobs we've lost since the signing of NAFTA. Some people toss around the number 6 million jobs. President Trump wants to scrap or renegotiate NAFTA. We talked about that at the top of the show. But here's the thing. It's really hard to know which job losses were actually caused by NAFTA. So today, a kind of thought experiment. What would have happened without NAFTA? Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
This is a what-if scenario, or if you're being fancy, it's a counterfactual. But really, it's the George Bailey question from the classic movie It's a Wonderful Life.
I suppose it'd been better if I'd never been born at all.
What'd you say?
I said I wish I'd never been born.
What if in 1994, NAFTA were never born? What would have happened to American factory jobs? Now, we don't have a low-ranking angel named Clarence to reveal this to us, but we do have professors, who do find the evidence awfully telling. Mauro Guillen at the Wharton Business School at Penn says a big job-killing wave would have hit anyway. Machines.
There is an element of truth that free trade has destroyed jobs in American manufacturing. But most of the jobs, up to 80%, have been destroyed by technology.
You know the story. ATMs replacing bankers, robots displacing welders. Automation is a very old story, but it has really picked up the last couple decades, and we're all endangered.
We economic developers have an old joke.
A few years back in North Carolina, Charles Hayes at the Research Triangle Regional Partnership put it to me this way.
The manufacturing facility of the future will employ two people. One will be a man, and one will be a dog. And the man will be there to feed the dog, and the dog will be there to make sure the man doesn't touch the equipment.
Ouch. But in fact, software replaced workers in the course of reporting this very story.
Hello.
Hi, this is Colin.
Yes, this is. Is this Scott?
Yes, Scott Tong at Marketplace. How are you?
I have to admit, this tech looks pretty cool. I've never seen it before, but you sound great, and hopefully this will record well and read well on the radio.
I interviewed political scientist Colin Hendricks at the University of Denver, and I recorded him with a cell phone app. That's it.
This interaction between you and me over this app probably would have involved at least one staff person setting things up or a recorder to make sure that it was captured, right? All of that's been lost to automation.
Which has nothing to do with trade or NAFTA.
We are in the midst of a sea change driven by technology that is radically altering the face of the U.S. economy. And clobbering Mexican workers is not going to solve that issue.
There's another big force affecting manufacturing jobs that also would have struck even if NAFTA had not been born. And that is China, says Wharton's Mauro Guillen.
You cannot rewind history. You cannot go back. But I think regarding NAFTA, if NAFTA had not taken place, I think that the American companies that decided to invest in Mexico would have probably decided to invest in China.
To save money and to stay in business. The impact of Chinese sewing machines and other machines and people operating them is what some call the China shock. And it far outdid the Mexico shock, says UC San Diego economist Gordon Hansen. He co-authored a paper on this question.
NAFTA gets blamed for a lot of ills in the U.S. economy, and I think unfairly. Mexico's production capacity just isn't that big. At the time the U.S. and Mexico and Canada signed NAFTA, Mexico's GDP was the equivalent of Ohio's.
No offense to Ohio, he hastens to add.
The China effect overwhelmingly dominates. And it's not hard to understand why. You know, the growth in Chinese manufacturing exports has simply been stupendous.
But again, most believe outsourcing has been swamped in the NAFTA years by the job-killing effects of automation, machines, software. Yet somehow it's unsatisfying to blame an electron. George Mason University economist Brian Kaplan is the author of The Myth of the Rational Voter.
Human beings tend to blame who they dislike for their problems, right? So if you stub your toe, like, who do I dislike that I might possibly blame for this? And in particular, what's very striking is they tend to be foreigners who are more different from you. So it's very rare that we go and talk about Canadians taking your jobs.
Which happens, by the way. But back to NAFTA and the George Bailey question from the movie. If the trade deal were never born, it seems evident that not much would have changed. The jobs would have left Bedford Falls anyway. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I want to turn the conversation now to a different kind of reimagined world. A cutting-edge healthcare therapy called gene editing. Scientists in China recently made a significant advance in gene editing technology. The tool they're using, called CRISPR, had, until recently, only been used on non-viable human embryos and in animals. But now, research is moving to viable human embryos, with potentially massive implications for human healthcare. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here to talk about this. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Lizzie.
What's happening with CRISPR right now in China, and can you explain why it's so significant?
Yeah, why this is such a big deal. What's happening is that research has been published for the first time that is about using CRISPR, which is this gene editing technology, to edit viable human embryos. So that is cells that could become healthy babies. Previously, this technology has only been used on embryos that already had serious genetic mutations. And they are these are immature embryos that are donated from fertility clinics. In the case of the Chinese research, the scientists were able to fully cure some genetic mutations that they had introduced and to partially cure others. Now, it's a really small study, but it represents sort of a major boundary that's being crossed here. One is in the editing of viable human embryos, which is obviously very controversial. But it's a big change because most of the CRISPR gene editing research so far has been on, you know, editing the DNA of pigs so that they could produce organs that are compatible with humans. Allergan this week paid $90 million for technology that can edit eye cells to cure blindness. That's very different from talking about editing, you know, an embryo, potentially a human being.
Well, when we're talking about viable human embryos, I mean, does this mean potentially speeding up what has been a slow, you know, research-driven process toward gene editing as a viable healthcare therapy?
Yeah, it's a major change. I mean, so gene therapy as a healthcare option has been around since probably the 80s. You know, it sort of started theoretically once people realized what the gene was in the 1950s, which is weird to think about. Before that, they didn't really know. And then there's been this idea since about the 80s of manipulating genomes using biotechnology. And that was what we call gene therapy. And then CRISPR comes along about 3 years ago and makes it easier, cheaper, and faster to do more specific actual editing. It's described in one article I read as a scalpel versus a sledgehammer. Here you have three-year-old technology that's already a giant leap forward. Then you're talking about potentially editing embryos, and that editing could potentially happen in vitro. And all of a sudden, just in 3 years, you've made a huge leap that could have really long-lasting impacts on, frankly, and I am not exaggerating, the future of our species. No big deal.
No big deal. You alluded to them. There are big ethical questions that hang out there with all of this. How do we balance sort of the potential medical steps forward and the quite understandable roadblocks that exist for ethical reasons there? I mean, do those things mean that this may not move into widespread medical technology in a time frame where you and I are around to see it?
You know, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is not that the roadblocks are not significant, which they are. And I think we're going to see very soon, especially as this research starts to come out, we're going to see a much louder conversation about the concerns and about how researchers should conduct themselves and what kind of research they could do. Because we've already had criticism ranging from the idea of designer babies and a have or have not society where some people are able to produce genetically superior children. The fears are significant and they're very real. The reason, though, that I think that this research will continue is that the hope and the potential for its use is so strong. That we're literally talking about treating or curing human diseases like cancer, cardiovascular disease, Parkinson's and other neurodegenerative conditions, diabetes, you know, all of these things that we have made very little headway on that affect millions and millions and millions and millions and billions of people. And so I think that the potential is so strong that I don't believe for a second that the research is gonna be stopped. And frankly, even if it's stopped in one country, it will probably occur in another country.
Well, let's talk about the have and have not question, because obviously right now we're talking about things at a research level. But is there also the potential risk that, you know, many of these therapies could be just unaffordable for people who want or need them?
Yeah, I think that is a real question. And I should be clear, I don't think we're going to have designer babies in the next 3 years or even the next 5 years. But, you know, I think this research will I think what we're seeing even just this week is that the future of gene editing is closer, probably. In fact, even a couple articles pointed out closer than we all thought. In the short term, I think there will inevitably be inequality in the way that it rolls out. We already know that if you are wealthy, you can get better access to healthcare. That is just a very unfortunate fact. And I think in this case, you know, we will certainly have gene editing therapies that are available to the wealthy first, or maybe only available if you have enough means. You know, CRISPR may make it cheaper and more broadly available, but it's still expensive. Even if you go from, you know, conventional gene therapy now is estimated to cost, you know, $1 million on average. CRISPR has the potential to reduce that cost to something more like $10,000. That's still really expensive. And that's assuming we get that cheap. And then on top of that, you'll have different regulations in different countries. And so there will probably be therapies that are available in expensive European clinics that are not available in the U.S.
Marketplace's senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We have two sides of the same story now about immigration. The Trump administration wants to overhaul immigration policy, and that includes the H-1B work visa program. Just 85,000 of these coveted visas get handed out every year. Employers pay a fee to enter a lottery system, then hire skilled foreign workers for each visa they win. Those workers generally hope the visas will lead to green cards later on, but green cards are handed out based on where someone was born.
there's a disproportionate number of Indian applicants. In 2015, India got about 70% of the H-1B visas issued. And the backlog is so bad that workers who applied 10 years ago are just getting answers today. Here's Sally Herships on what it's like to live in H-1B visa limbo.
This is the part in a story where normally we'd introduce you to a character to help draw you in and set the scene. Except almost all the workers on H-1Bs I talk to, more than 10, will not let me tell you their names, and they won't go on the radio. They're too scared. It's not just all the recent anti-immigrant sentiment. They're afraid of ruffling feathers at work. Each H-1B visa is tied to a specific job. Lose your job, lose the visa. One guy told me he feels pressure to keep every work relationship perfect. If not, his green card application could be on the line. Then I found Adi Agrawal.
I almost like woke up one day and I decided that I'm not really going to let this hold me back.
Hold him back from life. Agrawal is 38. He works in engineering in Houston. He's been in the U.S. for 14 years and waiting for his green card for 7. He says a couple of years ago, he just got tired of living in limbo.
Because, I mean, we have to live our lives. I might not get a green card for the next 10 years, so does it mean I'm going to not buy a car, not have a house, and not live my life?
Visa holders have to reapply every 3 years, and you better hope the worker processing your application is having a good day. If your visa doesn't get renewed, you get 60 days to leave the country. So for those workers, signing a lease or buying a car comes with extra stress. Imagine, one guy said, trying to sell that car or a house with 2 small kids in just 2 months. Agrawal lives in Houston with his wife, Shail Singh, a scientist. She's been on so many visas, it sounds like she's playing bingo.
I was on an F-1 and then I went on a J-1 and then I was on H-1B and now I'm on H-4.
Both Agrawal and Singh say over and over again how much they love the U.S. and how grateful they are for their lives here. Singh says she doesn't want to come off as political. Regardless of which party is in charge, the H-1B system needs an upgrade.
You notice that when your peers have moved ahead and you're still on an H-1B, it's not because you were not smart enough or you were not talented enough.
It might be because your boss is worried. What if that promotion you want requires travel? You could get stopped at the airport on the way back, stuck overseas. Towards the end of our interview, Singh asked if we could go off the record. Later, she agreed to let me play the tape.
Could I ask you a question off record, please?
Sure, of course.
Why is it that as a person who is willing to contribute to the society, why is it that my intentions are not communicated?
Singh says she doesn't hear enough stories from people like her, but she wants people to know a lottery is no way to determine someone's fate.
So that's the employee side of the story. Sally also looked at it from another perspective, the employer's. There's a price to enter the H-1B visa lottery, up to $4,000, and it's employers who have to pay. When it comes to H-1Bs, business owners also have plenty to grumble about. Here's Sally again.
There's really no polite way to say this. When it comes to the H-1B system, the tech industry is pissed off. It says H-1Bs prevent it from hiring the employees it needs. Just listen to Amal Sarva. He's based in New York. He's helped to found multiple startups like a smartphone company called Peak and Virgin Mobile USA.
You know, the fantasy of the H-1B opposition is that, oh yeah, sure, we'll just hire more out-of-work coal miners and bring them to New York, and it's not possible.
There are a lot of disagreements surrounding H-1Bs. Critics say jobs that should go to Americans are given away to cheap foreign labor. But Sarva says it's not that simple. This morning, we're visiting Knotel, another one of his companies. It provides customizable co-working space in New York. On the 5th floor, we stop by the desk of Kabir Chopra. He's Canadian, but originally from India. He's a Knotel client and CEO of his own company, which makes customizable sofas. Do you have any members of your staff who are on H-1Bs?
No, just me. Everyone else is American.
But Sarva says creating jobs is hard to do when you can't hire the workers you need. Even worse, H-1B rules are complicated. It's so bad that when I call the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services office to clarify the rules, the spokesperson there gets something wrong. She says when workers lose their visas, they have 10 days to leave the country, when really it's 60. Sarva says the problem isn't hiring skilled foreign workers.
far more real is if you can't get visas, you just open an office overseas.
Daniel Eobdia studies H-1Bs at Northwestern. He says another problem with the current system is it favors large companies. Remember, H-1Bs are based on a lottery, and you have to pay to enter. So if you need 100 workers with a special skill, a big company can afford to submit 3 times that many applications. Odds are it'll win the spots it needs. But a small company, which really needs 1 or 2 special workers, is likely out of luck. Just ask Ben Weber.
We didn't win the lottery. I mean, literally, did not win the lottery.
Weber is co-founder of Humanize, a small tech startup in Boston that analyzes productivity. And he is frustrated.
Our people are incredibly specialized and incredibly skilled. I can literally tell you, they create orders of magnitude more jobs than us hiring an entry-level employee. I mean, we will hire people to work for them.
If they can stay. Weber says if his workers don't get visas next time, he started pricing office space in Japan and Canada. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead.
Now is the part of the show where we ask people in the spotlight questions about work, money, and the lessons they've learned. It's called the Marketplace Quiz, and this week we have the hosts of a podcast I happen to love. And you will too, especially if you, like me, have only the vaguest idea who a lot of pop culture celebrities are.
I'm Lindsay Weber. I'm co-host of the podcast Who Weekly, a podcast about who's. Bobby, what's a who?
Well, don't you want me to introduce myself, or should I just go right into who's?
People don't need to know who you are.
I'm also a co-host of Who Weekly. My name is Bobby Finger. A who is a celebrity that you see everywhere. You hear their name all the time, but you're unsure of who they are, of what their job is. You know they're famous in some regard, but you're not exactly sure why.
That's good. That's it. Bobby, what is something that you've bought that you now completely regret buying?
That I completely regret buying? Well, I'll tell you. I have an answer to this. So last week I had the brilliant idea to get into jumpsuits. So I feel like I saw one during recent Fashion Week and I was like, uh-huh. I could pull that off. It's crazy for a normal person to look at a fashion show and say, I could pull that off, because you can't.
Yep.
But my big idea was that I was going to take it to a tailor and have it fitted to my body.
Uh-huh. I'm already like,
okay,
not...
Well, here's the problem. This is why I regretted it. So I got it and I was thinking, I think I could pull this off. But now I'm absolutely petrified of going to the tailor and saying,
putting on this jumpsuit.
And saying, can you fit this to my body? I can't bring myself to go to the tailor.
So you
now.
Just have this jumpsuit at your house that you're never going to wear?
I have it in my closet.
And you're never going to wear it?
It's like, it's a telltale heart in my closet.
Like when you come home every night, you feel it. You feel that it's there.
Mm-hmm. And it's only been 2 or 3 nights.
Wow.
It's the dumbest thing I've ever bought. Lindsay, what is the hardest part about being a who that nobody knows?
Name recognition. No, the hardest part of being a who that no one knows is you have to tell people who you are all the time, I assume. I think assuming people know who you are is a very tough line to cross. And if you assume that people know who you are, you're in trouble. But then if you introduce yourself, it's embarrassing. So, like, the whole introduction spiel, you know, you're like, oh, I'm nice to meet you. I'm Julianne Hough. And you're like, I know who you are. But most people don't know who you are.
Yeah.
So that's probably difficult, you know? Mm-hmm. Bobby, what is something everyone should own no matter the cost? It has to be an actual cost, not like a emotional cost.
No. Okay, Lindsay, I know. Existential marketplace.
You're like self-esteem.
Okay. I feel like I'm being very practical here.
Sure.
Number one is something that I have not yet bought myself, but will in the future because I keep realizing that it's worth it.
Okay.
One, a new bed. A good bed.
Oh.
Spending a lot of money on a bed.
Yeah, come on.
Number two, a cast iron pan.
Oh, yeah, duh.
The mattress, expensive.
But cast iron...
Cast iron pan, pretty cheap. You can cook so many things in cast iron pans, And if you and if it gets rusty, it gets dirty, guess what? You clean it off. They're like indestructible. Uh-huh, You'll take them with you forever.
Very practical, very practical.
Number three, these are the stupidest answers. Okay. I'm so sorry.
And yet you have three of them.
Number three is a Spotify subscription. A streaming music subscription.
Is this
people
an
complain.
Ad?
No, people or let's just say number three is a streaming music subscription.
Sure.
When I hear ads on it, it's like, come on. When people like it's such a small price to pay to get rid of ads, and it's you use it all the time. I can't really think of other things that are as essential
that
or
use
worth
every
it,
single
that I use every single day. Which is why I bring up cast iron pans, streaming music, mattress. What advice do you wish people had given Whos before they began their careers?
The more and more I read about Whos and I pay attention to their whereabouts and the industry that they work in, the more and more I realize how important it is to have a good publicist. If you see somebody everywhere and the kind of press that they're getting is something that you like, find out who their publicist is. This cannot be that hard. It's like when Celine Dion loved what Zendaya was wearing and said to whoever in her sphere, who is dressing her?
Someone said, Law Roach.
And someone said, this guy, Law Roach. This is one of the judges on America's Next Top Model, if you don't know who we're talking about. Point being, literally, a month later, Celine Dion is the best dressed person in Hollywood. She's all in fashion. She's at the fashion show. She's on every list. All it took was for her to say, I like this thing, I want it. And I know a lot of celebrities can do that, but I mean, as a Who starting out, your publicist can take you very far. I don't have a publicist, so I don't really know how that works, but I can imagine that it's not that hard to find yourself one that is good.
I think that's smart.
But also, I mean, as somebody who also works in pop culture stuff, you and I both get some of the worst press releases we've ever mm-hmm. seen. They're not in English. I mean, not like they're in other languages. Like, they're just nothing spelled right. Mm-hmm. It's confusing. There's no call to action as to what I can do to even be involved in this. It's just, like, not... Some people are just not smart. They don't know your name. There's a few very small things you can do to be a good publicist. And I just don't think that... I think the top 5% are the only ones doing it.
And it's probably worth the money.
Yeah, like a mattress.
Like a mattress.
You can listen to Who Weekly wherever you get your podcasts. When you think about virtual reality, maybe you think about gaming. Probably sounds kind of like this. But a lot of the VR that's being created today is much quieter. Think ocean sounds. Or really, really quiet. That's actually sound created for a museum. And museums are embracing VR, essentially creating new worlds with it. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has been reporting on this. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
How exactly are museums using virtual reality anyway?
Well, there are a couple ways. Some, like the Natural History Museum here in Los Angeles, are actually putting VR exhibits inside the museum. So on top of the general admission, I pay a little extra and I can go deep sea diving virtually. You know, you strap on the headset and go underwater. Other museums are adding virtual reality tours that you can actually take from your couch in your pajamas eating pizza. Basically, the idea there is to reach as many people as possible and get their collections out into the broader world. And then really interesting, museums like the New Museum in New York have commissioned artists to work in VR where VR is the medium. There's not actually a gallery presence for it except online through a headset.
How did this sort of come to pass anyway? I mean, why are museums experimenting with this kind of tech to begin with?
Well, in some ways, if you think about it, it's sort of a natural fit because VR, especially in these relatively early days, is such a visual medium and museums have huge visual collections. So it lines up nicely. I think as far as the in-museum exhibits where you actually pay to take a VR tour, part of that from the museum side is enticing folks in, getting them to come through the doors. One more reason to come check out a collection that maybe they've seen before and just haven't wanted to come back, haven't thought about coming back.
you mentioned the idea of sort of doing this on my couch in my pajamas, which sounds really appealing.
Lovely.
Then does that mean I have to, you know, walk through the doors of a museum anyway and pay? I mean, that I would imagine could hurt the bottom line of a museum in real life.
You know, that was a question I had about this. And apparently museums were worried about the same thing. And they found, I was told, the opposite, that when people saw something and realized it existed, maybe learned about it, they wanted to see it in real life. And it actually helped boost attendance in some cases, which I think is really interesting.
We played a little bit of sound earlier, and I feel like that gets to one of the questions here, in that there wasn't that much sound. So what's missing, I guess, in the way these things have been built so far?
Well, it gets to things like sound and smells, some of the other ways we experience museums that maybe we're not even thinking about quite as consciously as our visual sense. It's this sense of reality that all these things add up to. I asked the Smithsonian Sarah Snyder, she's the chief of media and technology there, sort of about what's missing, what VR isn't giving us.
We're hardwired at some level to crave interaction with the real world, and we haven't reached a point yet with technology where it is as satisfying to do things together online as it is to do things together in real life.
One of the things she points to that's lacking in today's VR, especially with these museum tours, is sound, as we know, which is a part of the museum experience.
What I always notice is the sound of being in a hallway with these marble floors and stone columns and the subtle echoes that you hear as people move through the conversations you overhear that others are having.
There's a little ambient sound on the Smithsonian's VR tour, but it's not the same sense I would have if you passed me in the hallway, Lizzie, and I would hear your feet. Those sort of interactional sounds and that sound of passing aren't there. And that's something these things are missing.
You know, it's funny to hear you say that. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and going to the Smithsonian was a huge part of my childhood. Listening to you, I can picture what those dinosaurs looked like and the smell in those galleries. And when we think about all of this, where do we go from here, from this sort of embryonic version of museums and VR to the future?
Well, I think there are a couple ways the technology could improve. I mean, one is that it could become a more fully immersive experience, that there could be a way that we can really feel like we're in a museum with the crowds of children rushing by, with the smells of the dinosaur hall, sort of through some magical smell-o-vision that hasn't been invented yet. There's also a way that museum futurists like Elizabeth Merritt from the American Alliance of Museums says that museum VR exhibits could become a whole new way to explore art.
And if you could reach out and virtually pick up that beautiful jar you're looking at and see what it looks like on the backside or turn it over to see the maker's mark on the bottom, that makes it much more seamless. It makes it much more integrated, and it makes people feel like they have more control over what they're seeing.
There are lots of ways that museums, if you got to that point where the technology was better, either more immersive or more sort of augmented reality, where we could experience these collections in new ways that would make the trip to the museum that much more meaningful. Merritt says there's a lot of potential here, but it's going to take some time to grow.
If there's anything that we have learned about technology in museums over the past couple of decades, is that it doesn't really work well until that technology is so ubiquitous that people bring it themselves.
Well, that raises the question, where's the technology industry in all of this?
They love it. I mean, the idea for them is that museums can be a place where people try on VR goggles for the very first time. Part of the problem with VR is it's hard to get people over that first point of trying it. And so museums can be a really good place for people to actually test out the technology and to see what it might do for them. So the industry as a whole, I think, love the fact that museums are sort of moving in this direction.
Marketplace's Adrienne Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Many Britons responded to the attacks on Parliament this past week by embracing the keep calm and carry on spirit. Our colleagues at the BBC covered the tragic news while also continuing to tell creative British stories like this, which brings together Shakespeare and funk music. Soul singer Laura Mvula composed the music for a new production of Antony and Cleopatra at the Royal Shakespeare Company. The BBC's Rebecca Jones has this story.
If it be love, indeed, tell me how much.
There's beggary in the love that can be reckoned.
Antony and Cleopatra wasn't a play I'd covered at school. So, did all my reading and research, didn't understand a word of it. Panicked. But this is what I want to do. This is what I've been wanting to do since I was 12, 13, write music for theatre and film. And here's my first gig. So, and it's not a bad first gig.
Laura Mvula sang in church choirs as a child growing up in Birmingham and went on to study composition at the city's conservatoire. And she was in no doubt how she wanted her music to sound for Shakespeare's tragic love story.
I knew immediately I had this palette forming that was somewhere between Prince's Purple Rain and Miles Davis's Sketches of Spain.
And Laura Mvula is working with the RSC's band in Stratford-upon-Avon to make it a reality.
We need the D and E in the bass.
Yes.
We're going to get
there. So, first time around you go.
It involves me being present in lots of rehearsals, lots and lots of dialogue back and forth between myself and the director. Things change all the time.
And the director, Iqbal Khan, is keeping her busy.
And it's all about responding. Okay, this underscoring here doesn't work because we can't hear that monologue. I remember the time when I thought I'd written the most exciting melody for a particular scene. So excited for Iqbal to hear it. And he was like, no, it's too busy. Don't need that melody there. And I was like, oh my God. But it's great. It's exciting and challenging.
Laura Mvula emerged in 2013 with her debut album, Sing to the Moon. It made the top 10 and picked up Brit, Mercury and Ivan Novello nominations.
Take me outside, sit in the green garden.
But after her second album, The Dreaming Room, sold less well, her label Sony dropped her from a 5-record deal.
I think I was definitely naive in the beginning. You know, when I was signed, I just thought, when someone says, we love you and we're with you to the end, that's what they mean. Doesn't work like that. It's business.
And you have been dropped now.
I have.
By your record label. How much of a shock was that?
You know, when I received the forwarded email of 7 lines that said, thank you for your efforts and we wish you the best for the future, I think first was I was confused. I didn't understand. I guess in my head, I always imagined that maybe there would be a conversation, a renegotiation, but never a kind of, it's over.
Are you telling me you were dropped from your record label by email?
Absolutely.
Nobody rang you?
No. I didn't see anyone. I didn't hear anybody's voice. I just read words. It felt so sort of cold and cruel.
Hey there, you shattered in a thousand pieces.
The label says her manager was told face-to-face that the contract wouldn't be renewed. But Laura Mvula heard by email before he'd had a chance to speak to her. So what happens next?
I don't know. Take your broken wings and fly. I'm doing this music for Antony and Cleopatra. To come at a time when I feel sort of rejected by the mainstream. Well, it kind of feels like, you know what, too right, I don't belong there and that's fine. Painful as it is in the beginning. Then I realised that people really genuinely love the music. And go figure, that's the important thing. So, yeah, running free.
And that's our show for this week. A big thanks to Boise State Public Radio for being awesome hosts this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills, with help from Danielle Stevens. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.